What brought you to this residency?
I've been tattooing for about 21 years. I've tattooed over 10,000 people, and the majority of my clients are here in California, both Northern California, here in the LA area, and Oceanside. And when the museum opened, I was quite intrigued because it is kind of the first of its type, and had met Brenna several years ago. And then with the Living Arts Showcase that they host annually, she suggested that I come tattoo at the museum and do a demo during that event and then stay the following week and see all of my clients there. And it's just a fantastic little venue and a very nice space.
Wonderful, wonderful. And how did you get involved in traditional tattooing? I was going to say Polynesian, but it's not just Polynesian, is it?
No, that's true. I I specialize in the Pacific. But for example, Lakota people believe that they have to have a tattoo that represents the four directions before they can get into the afterlife. So I've done half a dozen Lakota people with their traditional symbols, usually elders from that community. I've done some Japanese family Mon and that sort of thing. I strictly do black graphics. I don't do any color or anything representational. But what brought me to it is kind of a long story. My bachelor's degree was in art history, and I was immediately attracted and drawn towards what they used to call primitive art, African and oceanic in particular. So I started studying Pacific art back in the 1970s and worked for some time at the Denver Art Museum as assistant curator in Native Arts. And the bulk of that collection is Native American, and the curator is a Native American specialist. So by default, all the African and oceanic fell under me. And I used to walk by a photo of a tattooed Marquesan every day and think, why in the world would anybody ever do that? I really had no interest in tattoo, but I did have a genuine interest in the culture and the art. So it was much later, 20 years later, that at the University of Hawaii, I found myself in the anthropology department rather than art history. I had started off in art history, but their degree is art of Asia and the Pacific. And by that time, I knew what my focus was, and that's the Pacific. So I switched to anthropology, and fortunately, they do allow for a very broad focus and emphasis. They understand that you have to know something about the legends, the mythology, the religion, in order to understand the culture. You can't just look at one thing. So I wound up doing my master's thesis on the ancient form of Marquesan tattoo. And it qualified as an archaeological topic because tattoo tools are found in archaeological context. And I would give occasional lectures at the university and other places, the museums in Honolulu. And at one of those events, we had a very large crowd. And I'm at a lit podium. I can't see who's in the audience. But a question came up that I couldn't answer about the new tribal movement. And I'll say new tribal in quotations, because there truly isn't much that's tribal about most Polynesian tattoo. The Maori people had tribes, and there were truly tribes in Fiji. But beyond that, the word tribe indicates kind of a hunter-gatherer type society that doesn't have permanent villages, domesticated animals, and agricultural systems. And Polynesian cultures typically do have all of those things, so they're not really tribal in that sense. But a question came up, and I couldn't answer it, and I couldn't see a gentleman in the back of the room who was raising his hand. And he came forward and took the podium and said, well, when I tattooed Leo's back, and I immediately knew this was Ed Hardy. So I said, Mr. Hardy, please take the podium. And I took a seat in the front row. And we kind of started a friendship, and sometime later, I had taken a volunteer shipboard position on a Scripps vessel that was measuring seafloor spreading and going to Rapa Nui or Easter Island for their eighth time. Usually they take oceanography students, PhD students, on these voyages as their scientific party, which is all volunteer. But I think that they wanted somebody that knew the culture, history, the origins, the legends, and the background of something about the island. No one on board any of these cruises did. So I took this volunteer position, which meant that I had an open-ended ticket return home through Tahiti, which is really where I wanted to do my doctoral research, and that I had no baggage restrictions. So I have been corresponding with a number of people on the island that had a genuine interest in Polynesian tattoo, but nobody had done any. There was no tattooing occurring on the island at that time. And I had sent them bibliographies and lists of everything we have in any museum or library in Hawaii and said, "Do you have copies of this?" And they responded that, "Well, we might, but islanders aren't allowed access to our library." Which didn't really sink in with me until I got there. And I tried to visit the library and was denied access.
So who was the library for?
Well, that's a good question. There is an organization called the Easter Island Foundation, which is phenomenal. And anybody with an interest in the Pacific in general, especially Easter Island or Rapa Nui, should join. Their website is islandheritage.org. And about every 5 years, they host a conference, and it is Pacific-wide, even though the name would suggest otherwise. And this year, we're lucky. It's happening here in California in Napa in July, July 8th through 13th. And there will be a lot of papers on various aspects of not only Rapa Nui culture, but Pacific culture in general. So this organization was founded with the sole purpose of building a library on the island that would be for islanders. And that has now happened. But back to how I started tattooing, I was meeting with Hardy periodically, and one day over lunch showed him a lot of Xeroxes of old Rapa Nui tattoos. And he said, "Wouldn't it be cool to give him the real thing instead of a photocopy?" So I said, "Sure." And he kind of encouraged me to take up tattooing and gave me a little bit of guidance. He didn't apprentice me by any means because he only lives in Hawaii. He tattooed in San Francisco. But that was what kind of motivated me to take up the art, was to return it to the people of Rapa Nui. And I wound up tattooing 45 people, all native designs. They drew their own art. I just tattooed over it. I gave them skin markers, and we draw all over each other at night, which was great fun. And let him wear that for a few days and say, "Le gusta, le gusta," and then just tattoo over it for him. And I apprenticed two locals, and I kind of thought that would be the end of it. I'd go back to academia. And I found I really like tattooing in that it provides such instant, intimate friendships. Most people want something that really represents who they are and what's important to them. And there's no other art form, and very little that we could do in life, that really gives you this sort of close connection and intimacy on an almost immediate level. So I really love that about tattoo. The reality of sitting there hunched over in horrible positions for hours that causes neck and wrist damage and carpal tunnel and compressed discs, and exposing yourself to bodily fluids all day is horrible. Hauling all of this gear around is awful. But it's the people that keep me at it and keep me doing it.
Let me just go back for 1 second. So you didn't apprentice with Hardy. Did you apprentice? Did you?
No, Hardy watched over me as I tattooed myself, and it was with a young, part Marquesan Tahitian gentleman named Ricky Marchand, who's also a phenomenal artist. And he also has a sincere interest in Marquesan design. So Ricky and I tattooed ourselves at my house while Ed watched over our shoulder. He gave me some guidance in what equipment to buy. And encouraged me to dismantle and reassemble machines for hours and hours and hours. His theory, I think, was that you better understand how a machine works especially if I was heading off to places like Rapa Nui,
right,
where if your machine breaks, you better be able to fix it,
right,
and learn to troubleshoot some pretty wacko power systems. And so, no, I didn't do a formal apprenticeship at all, but rather learned on myself and a few friends, and then on Rapa Nui.
Did you ever have any experience working with traditional tools?
Yeah, before I had met Hardy, when I had was doing my research, I thought, well, I really have no right to do this unless I've experienced it. So I've built every type of tool imaginable that was used by any traditional culture, and initially tattooed my inner thighs without pigment. I just thought I need to feel it. And the only one that I really found pretty unbearable is certain Native American peoples would basically use a needle and thread, although a pine needle of sorts back in the old day, and run it under their skin. And then today, people that do practice this technique, and there's very, very few, ink the thread and pull the thread through. That's pretty miserable. I really don't recommend that. But other than that, the traditional techniques really aren't that much more painful. In some cases, they're less so than the machine.
Well, and also it's a different kind of delivery. It's a different. It produces a different result too. Doesn't it?
It does, very much so. The traditionally applied tattoos are much bolder. There tends to be much more blurring because you can't control the depth. Ideally, a tattoo wants to be placed right between the epidermis and the dermis. And if you go too light, it heals out and fades. If you go too deep, it blurs. Mm-hmm. So proper depth is critical, and you really can't control that nearly as much with traditional tools as you can with a machine. And it's a much blockier, bolder look, or it's oftentimes very simple little motifs that look like the letter X, the letter Y. In ancient Tahitian society, traditional tattoos really just look like little repeated letters, letter X's and letter W's. And the same with the Samoan woman's tattoo, especially the tattoo that went on the hand. Very simplistic.
Interesting. So when you began to work outside of Easter Island, and when you began to accept that this was maybe something that you were going to do seriously, I mean, how did you begin to connect to these communities?
Well, that's also kind of a funny story. What had happened is I never really made that decision. Sometimes I just feel like a marionette puppet, kind of being led down a certain path, trying not to tangle my strings. But I returned from Rapa Nui, and I had been gone 7 months because I did stay over for some time afterward and stay in Tahiti. And the gentleman that I had sublet my room to wouldn't move. So he really didn't want to leave. And I said, look, you've already had an extra 3 months. So we compromised, and there's a hula hala, or a dance group, that's actually very well known for their Tahitian dance skills, Otea Api, up in Fremont in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I had tattooed that family, and they had said, please come out to California. You can stay with us and tattoo among our halau. So when I got back and found that my room was fully occupied and the tenant did not want to leave, I thought, well, it's the perfect time to go to California for a little while. So I went out for, I think, probably 6 weeks and started tattooing in the San Francisco area. And there's a lot of hula groups there and outrigger clubs and Hawaiian softball leagues and such. So I kind of tapped into that community and started commuting, and I'm currently on my 101st tattoo trip to here to the mainland.
Wow.
Yeah.
So then let's talk a little bit about the art itself. You know, you were saying that in Rapa Nui, the people that you were working with had created their own designs for you to then ink up. Yeah. Right. Can you talk a little bit about, you were saying it's not representational, generally speaking, is that true?
Generally speaking, that's true, although it's really hard to make generalizations across cultures, even within Polynesia, because they are really very different. They do share a common ancestral culture. It was the migrations that initially came out of island Southeast Asia in the northwestern Pacific and then gradually spread across the Pacific down to Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, where they settled for another 1,500 years and developed the traits that we typically call Polynesian traits before expanding eastward into remote Oceania. Those are kind of critical concepts because in the Western Pacific, all the islands are intervisible. You can stand on one and see the next. So navigation is no huge deal, and you don't have to be able to prepare food for long-term storage and that sort of thing. Voyaging is easy. Whereas once you reach that Fiji, Tonga, Samoa area, the distances become much, much greater. So it became long-distance voyaging. So different navigational skills were needed, different ocean-going craft, food preservation. So there is a distinct difference. And what happened was as each one of these island groups was colonized, they gradually developed their own distinct cultural traits, their own dialects of the language, their own styles of clothing, tapa making, their own arts, and their own style of tattoo. So it is pretty hard to make generalizations from one culture to the next. Especially when we look at Aotearoa or New Zealand. Maori tattoo is very different, and the environment's very different. It's subtropical. So if you imagine when those first settlers landed there on Aotearoa, New Zealand, it's cold. None of the plants are familiar. None of the animals are familiar. So it took a whole different set of skills to just adjust to their environment. So my theory and my guess is that first couple of generations, they weren't tattooing. Mm-hmm. It was all they could do to adjust to and learn their new environment and basically figure out survival skills and then eventually dedicate themselves to leisure arts like tattooing and carving. Mm-hmm. So that's perhaps why the Maori tattoo is so significantly different than the rest of Polynesia. In the Marquesas, they were tattooed the most extensively. Men were tattooed from head to toe. Women were tattooed on the hands, the feet, around the lips, and just beneath the ear. And there was a very strict set of kapu, or rules or regulations surrounding tattoo. There was a tattoo season. It happened during their equivalent of makahiki or matahiti in Tahitian, which is a period of leisure. It's the harvest season. Inner island travel is forbidden during this time of year. Food is in abundance. It's a time of games, a time of happiness. Warfare, bloodshed are forbidden. So it's the time where you're safe to tattoo. You're not going to get conked over your head by your neighbor, cannibalized, basically. So in the Marquesas, fortunately, too, tattoo was very well documented, and that isn't the case in all island groups. But certain threads are found throughout all of the Polynesian islands.
Interesting. And do you think that the art itself arises from, is it purely a cultural expression, or do you think that there's something environmental that kind of brings people to that sort of artistic view? I don't know if you understand my question, but
yeah, kind of, I guess. That's a hard question.
It's so distinctive. It's really, yeah. You look at it, and even though there's differences from culture to culture within the Pacific Islands, you know, it's just so distinctive. It's
mm-hmm. Certain tattoos, I think, were very, very deeply embedded within their whole social religious system, or what I'll call the kapu system. Being that I'm from Hawaii, I'll tend towards Hawaiian words rather than tapu or taboo, but it's basically the same word. And people often think of that as being just forbidden. But no, it has to be handled very carefully. It's restricted because it's embedded with the spirits of the ancestors or the gods. Mm-hmm. It's something highly sacred or highly contaminated. And it is also used to refer to the whole kind of social structure and social system. And it seems only logical that when you find something in every culture, clear back to the earliest people that eventually colonized the Pacific, there's a real reason for it. And certain tattoos are that common and that ancient. The woman's hand tattoo is practiced in almost every culture throughout the Pacific, including the ancestral societies. The tattoo that goes from knees to waist that we associate with Samoan men, the Pe'a, in the Western Pacific, it was a woman's tattoo. And in the Western Pacific, women did the tattoos. And in almost every culture, women had their genital area tattooed. So certain tattoos like these had to have been done for a reason. And we could talk forever on that topic, but it has to do with the control of things, kapu and mana. When you're dealing with something sacred, and typically those sacred, restricted activities are assigned to women, like the taupo in Samoan culture, kind of the village chief's daughter, is assigned the duty of making kava, which is kind of a sacred ceremony, and her hands have to be tattooed in order to do so. In the Marquesas, it was recorded that a woman with untattooed hands couldn't eat from the same bowl as a woman with tattooed hands. A woman couldn't rub a deceased family member's body with coconut oil daily, which they did do, until her hands were tattooed. She couldn't effus the flesh for secondary burial of the bones until her hands were tattooed. So when we look at all of these duties assigned to women that necessitated a hand tattoo, it must have had something to do with the control of kapu and mana. Mm-hmm. And there's two very prominent concepts within Polynesian culture, and that's ao and po. Po is the spirit world, the world of the ancestors, the world of the gods. It's pre-birth, it's post-death, it's the dream state. Ao is the waking world, the conscious world, right now. And passage between ao and po is critical. And the ultimate passage? Birthing. So perhaps this is why, particularly in so many Western Pacific societies, women always had their mai, or their private areas, tattooed.
Mm-hmm. So it was really a spiritual kind of protection or
in some cases,
you know.
I wouldn't carry that line of thought too far. Some researchers have and thought that tattooing the body provides somewhat of a spiritual armor. I don't necessarily agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think that that's really extrapolating.
Well, the reason why I mentioned that at all is because I was talking to an artist who was at the Payam event this last weekend, and he's from Papua New Guinea, and I was asking him, he was a woodcarver, and I was asking him what the traditional uses of these wood carvings were in Papua New Guinea. And he said, well, generally speaking, they would be placed outside the home to protect it from, you know, evil spirits,
right,
basically. And I was just wondering if that was analogous to the tattooing process as well.
There's not much that would really support that, no. Some people have argued that, and maybe, but I'm just going to say maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. And part of a tattoo is it means and serves whatever purpose the individual has in mind, which is really very true of memorial tattoos and certain other tattoos. You know, if someone passes, a family member, someone you're very close to, oftentimes people get a memorial tattoo, And it keeps that person alive in their life. In some cases, it's done on the back. In traditional Marquesan culture, there was a specific tattoo done by the descendants of a certain chief put in the center of the back to watch over your back. Now, the backbone in Polynesian culture is also the iwikuomo'o in Hawaiian, but it's symbolic of your genealogy. So it's a very meaningful place to put a tattoo. And a tattoo that does mark genealogy would very likely be placed there.
Interesting. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the scope of your work. I know that you mentioned that you've worked on, you said over 10,000?
Over 10,000, close to 11.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But the other thing is that you're sort of moving, you're sort of nomadic in a sense, you know. And,
it's true.
And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that works and you know, how, you know, you move through these different communities and leave sort of a tangible
mark.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
hopefully,
yeah.
I'll be remembered. The economy is bad everywhere, but Hawaii especially is challenging. When I first started tattooing, there were only 5 shops on the island, and it was very territorial. You don't open a shop in the wrong place. And I opted to, well, part of it was a conscious decision, part of it wasn't. Like I mentioned, my room was occupied, and this group in San Francisco had said, well, come out and tattoo here. So part of it was just circumstance, but there are a lot of Pacific Islanders here in California. And a lot of people that aren't Islanders themselves but are very connected to the culture, either they married into it or they've lived for extended periods, you know, in various places, Hawaii or Tahiti or elsewhere, Fiji. So these are the people that I really cater to. And even though California has been hit pretty hard with the economy, it's not to the extent that Hawaii has. If you think about it, Hawaii's whole economy is tourist-based. And leisure vacations is the first thing that people eliminate. And you think that, oh, that affects the hotels and such, but no, it trickles down. I have friends that are papaya farmers that have a huge farm on the Big Island. And one of their biggest contract was one of the big hotel chains. So even the farmers and the growers, everybody is affected. So I think that that's definitely why so many Hawaiians are living here on the mainland. There's just so much more opportunity and more work. And Hawaiians here are kind of desperately clinging to any thread of their culture. They want a reminder of back home. Even in Hawaii, a fair number of the tattoos that I do are on young people that are going away to college. They're usually very small pieces that we can build on later just to remind them of what their roots are and where they belong and to bring them back home. So it's a tangible reminder for people here of who they are and where they come from. And again, there is a huge Polynesian community here, but it used to be that about 80% of my clients were actually Islander, and that's certainly changed over the last decade with the internet and my website and such. So now I would say that more like about 35 to 40% are actually Islanders, and the rest just have some affiliation or love for the culture or married into it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there kinds of work that you just choose not to do?
Yeah, definitely. I certainly don't, again, do anything that's truly representational, like I'm trying to think of a recent example. Oh, here's a good one. What many people think of here as being that Ikaika helmet, or the warrior's helmet of Hawaii, which is truly a misnomer. That's not a warrior's helmet at all. We don't fully understand what it was, but it's a gourd helmet that fits very loosely with just little small areas cut out of it for the eyes. Certainly not practical for going into battle. The warrior's helmet was called a mahiole and is a very tightly knit, fitting, woven helmet that's sometimes covered with feathers. But those are often hung in the rearview mirrors of cars. They've become just a common symbol for the Hawaiian Islands and for islanders. But there's really no historic basis in that. They were used in Hawaii, but under very sacred, limited circumstances. So I don't do those. And those are fairly commonly requested. Anything that, from the ancient documentation, which I'm pretty familiar with since I did do my grad work in that, I wound up focusing really on the accuracy of these early records and early illustrations. So anything that's indicated in those early documents that could be reserved for the chiefly class, I won't replicate. And replicating any tattoo from either the old sources verbatim or from anybody else's tattoo is just absolutely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, in Polynesian culture, tattoos today are created for that individual with symbols that and combinations and numbers that have meaning for that person. Oftentimes, the number of immediate family members or numbers of generations going back to a certain person are repeated. Oftentimes, there's symbols for each child, for a grandparent, for whoever. So, and this isn't necessarily an ancient practice, but we're modern people. Mm-hmm. So today what we're doing is creating designs that have meaning for that individual that are done in a traditional vein, mm-hmm. using traditional motifs. In some cases, we don't even know what the ancient motifs really, truly meant. In some cases, we do. Like in the Marquesas, it was very well documented. But in many island groups, it's speculation. So we're taking design elements and then recombining them and finding elements that might have some relation to that individual and creating something that really represents something that's sacred and dear to them. So taking that out of context or taking that and putting it on anything else or copying that in somebody else's tattoo is just absolutely inappropriate.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. And it's truly kind of an insult to the individual that's wearing the original. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it does commonly happen. Mm. So I often find myself in the role of like Facebook copyright police. Me and three or four other Polynesian style artists that all recognize each other's work. There's quite a few tattooists doing this now, but only a handful of us that have been at it 20 years or more, and will recognize each other's work in a second, or will recognize a copy.
Well, and that's actually really interesting too, is that at some point you must have realized that your work was evolving to the point where it was distinctively you.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I asked one of the Tahitian elders this 15 years ago. In Tahiti, the revival started in 1982 when Tavana Salmon, who was at one time resident of Hawaii and owned the Tahitian Lanai and had a very successful dance group and performance group there, he took one of his young dancers, Teve, to Samoa. And Teve was the first one to get tattooed in a full Marquesan body style because Teve's part Marquesan. And then they went to Tahiti and they sponsored two Samoans to come and demonstrate the art of Samoan tattooing at their Heva, or the Bastille Day festivities. And this was when Tahitians first had the opportunity to observe tattooing in 200 years. Tattooing was banned on Tahiti by the Tahitian chief, Pomari, in the Pomari Code of 1819. It wasn't a missionary ban, although missionaries discouraged it. So this was the springboard for the Tahitian revival. But unfortunately, Tahitian tattoo was very poorly documented, and all they had access to was a few Xerox and pages from Marquesan sources. So they wound up reviving Marquesan tattooing, not Tahitian tattooing. And one of my goals very early on was to photocopy everything in our libraries, especially anything in French, because they can read it, all of the early manuscripts, and bring it back to them. And this particular elder was someone that I would bring hundreds of pages, literally, of old chants and old material to, because he is a pretty prominent character and could utilize it and put it back in the right hands and make use of what's locked away in museums and rare collections and libraries. So anyway, after a few years of going back and forth and spending, you know, extended periods there and seeing the revival change from replication of traditional Marquesan designs to this new kind of neo-Marquesan inspired contemporary style that incorporates dolphins and suns and manta rays, I asked him, what do you think of this? Because I was just a little bit bothered by it. And what bothers me is ultimately it leads to a lack of knowledge of what the historic roots are and what the traditions are. Mm-hmm. When people start thinking that this dolphin is a traditional Marquesan tattoo motif, you know, there's something wrong when the youth don't even recognize a Tahitian tattoo mm-hmm. when they see the old illustrations. And recently there was a PhD student from Spain that came through Honolulu, heading to Aotearoa, and Australia, and then Tahiti, looking for a dissertation topic. And I wound up making printouts of about 16 images of old Tahitian tattoos and numbering for her. And said, why don't you just ask all the Tahitian tattooists, hey, can you help me identify these? What are these? Do you recognize any of these? And only 3 tattooists could identify one of those drawings as being Tahitian. So it's kind of sad, but that's the ultimate end result when we start really tweaking and getting carried away with modifying the traditional designs. Now, I'm not saying that we should replicate the old. We shouldn't. We're modern people, and many of us are not from those cultures. So what right do we even have to wear this stuff? And the Marquesans, the elders and those involved with the arts organizations there, their take on it was that if you don't replicate it, change it, make it your own, make it unique, it's fine. It's acceptable.
Right.
So that's fine, and that's what's happening today. And when I was discussing it with the Tahitian gentleman, he said, well, you know, at one point we're artists. When we reach a point where we understand we can replicate the old stuff, of course we're going to get creative and create something new. And I think that that's fine and that's wonderful, and that's basically what I do. But again, the downside of that is the younger artists don't know the historical roots. And I think that's where I differ from most tattooists here today. There's a lot of tattooists doing Polynesian style and doing it fairly well. But I will sit with my clients and say, okay, this is inspired by a traditional Marquesan motif first recorded in 1803, and it means this. I've tweaked it in this manner. Or this is a Neo-Maori motif that means this. It's a koru. It's symbolic of new growth and new life. It comes from the new growth of the tree fern. You know, we're borrowing this from Maori culture. Or this is something that I totally made up. It's filler, call it whatever you want. There's a motif that I call Adam Had a Zit, because Adam, a young client of mine, I was doing a shoulder piece, and he had a zit on his arm, and you can't tattoo over a pimple. So I left a perfect round little circle and left a few others to balance it out, and talked to him my next California trip, because I'm out here quite frequently, and said, Adam, do you want to fill up those holes, those puka? Pukas are the Hawaiian word. And he said, no, I kind of like them. And other people have seen it in my portfolio and wanted it, and they asked me what it means, and I'll say, Adam, how does it? I'm not likely to make up something, but what's really amusing is now the Marquesans have picked it up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So One of the things when I was listening to you talking about the Tahitians and the young Tahitians who are kind of coming into tattooing on their own right, you were talking about before we started this conversation that you were working with young people who, as like a mentor. They were apprenticing with you, learning the process. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and why you do that and what it means, both for the individuals and for the communities they're involved in.
Yeah, I've had a number of apprentices, more than I can count, both here and in the islands, particularly in the islands. When I first started going to Tahiti, there was a total lack of knowledge or hygiene. The lack of hygiene was really frightening. They would pour the ink into the bottle cap, tattoo out of the bottle cap, and pour the remaining ink back in. Yeah. So I set aside 50% of my income, and this was part of the reason I kept tattooing, was it allowed me to buy them supplies and equipment. And to try and set up a program through their Territorial Action Office of Action and Culture in Action, in French is the name of it, to where Tahitians could go and get literature in Tahitian on proper hygiene. Simple things like bleach kills AIDS. One part in 10 bleach and water will kill HIV in 15 seconds. Clean up with bleach. So getting the information out there and getting supplies, free gloves, free needles, free ink caps out to them. And their Arts and Culture Office had initially agreed to be the distributor and then pulled out. So I realized the only way I can do this is to go out and spend time, you know, out in the rural districts with each one of these artists. So I spent 37 months in Tahiti, cumulatively over 17 trips, bringing equipment down. And at this point, nobody was using traditional tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody had tapped there in 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were using homemade machines from razors, electric shavers, and Walkman engines, and that sort of thing, like kids here do. So that kept me going back to Tahiti and kind of kept me tattooing. So with apprenticing, the islanders, part of my intention is to keep the art alive or revive it. Part of it is to put the original material and the early documentation back into their hands so that they have access to their history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my motivation in writing and publishing these books. And I am doing a book on each of the island groups. I'm now working on books 3, 4, and 5 simultaneously, which is a challenge, but another story. So getting the information back into their hands and then teaching them proper hygiene. Although that was really 20 years ago. Now we're at the point where there is some phenomenal artists doing excellent work and that have access to professional equipment, that have traveled to conventions and so forth. So it's kind of a different world in the Society Islands or on Tahiti. That isn't the case in some of the more remote islands. In some places, they really are having a tough time. Like Renal and Bologna, which are Polynesian outliers. They're culturally and linguistically and artistically part of Polynesia. They're Polynesian people by blood, but they're politically located within the Solomon Islands. Tikopia still has a few people, women mostly, that are tattooing themselves. Ontong Java, same thing. Tattooing in Ontong Java was just banned in 1984. So some of the remote islands, you know, the tradition is to some degree carried on. And some of the artists in these places really do have a difficult time getting access. So that's of the highest importance to me, is aiding them in any way that I can. Whether it's getting them high-quality equipment or knowledge of how to use such, making videos on how to tattoo clean island style, For example, if you don't have professional ink cups, open a fresh bottle of water and use the bottle cap. But it can't be a bottle cap of a bottle you've drunk out of. Just simple things like that we have on video that I can send out to the more remote islands. And here and in Hawaii, it's a little bit different. My goal in Hawaii is to see somebody using traditional Hawaiian style combs and tools, and no one is. For the most part, the traditional techniques that have been revived and that we commonly see are Samoan. And Hawaiian tools were very, very different. So I've hand-selected a few Hawaiian apprentices over the years who are sculptors, who are capable of making Hawaiian-style combs and reviving the Hawaiian techniques, which again are light years apart from the Samoan method, and nobody has yet to do it. I'm kind of cracking the whip there on a few of them. And here, I choose apprentices that, number one, are willing to help me out in working these festivals and hauling all this gear around. And number two, have some background knowledge. If they don't have any knowledge of the culture, we're starting from ground zero. And boy, that's tough. So they really have to have a pretty strong grounding in some aspect of the culture, which is easy here if they were raised within, you know, a Samoan or a Polynesian family, or if they've danced hula for many years. So I've had fewer apprentices here in California than I have had elsewhere.
And do you feel like as these apprentices go through the process of working with you and then move off to work on their own, do you feel that they are now equipped to find their own voice, you know, within the structures of the culture that they're working in?
Most definitely. Some of the Marquesans that I started working with in 92, 93 are now the top tattooers in French Polynesia. And also, maybe among the most commercial, there are those that are attending tattoo conventions and are really putting themselves out there. And they're phenomenal. And I'm really proud of them, especially on the hygiene front. They're wearing full plastic sleeves when they're doing bigger pieces. They're bagging their machines. They're taking every precaution as far as hygiene goes. So that really makes me feel good. In order to even think about doing an apprenticeship, somebody's got to have some fairly good artistic ability. They also have to have the ability to deal with people. A lot of what we do is psychology. When somebody's nervous, we have to talk them through it and calm them down and know when they've reached their limit and so on, and to help them through the guidance process of what design they're going to get and when they're really ready for it. So, yeah, all of my apprentices do have artistic ability, or I probably wouldn't take them on, in addition to having some cultural and background knowledge on the history of their own culture. Not necessarily of all of the islands. I have some that definitely specialize in, say, Tonga and Samoa, you know, or definitely have their areas of expertise. And some of them have been very good artists in other medium before they've taken up tattooing. One of them, Jordan Sousa, who occasionally comes out here with me, was a very successful wood carver and artist before he took up tattoo. And I would say he's one of the top tattooists in the state now, and definitely has his own style and his own take on traditional culture and what's appropriate and what isn't. One thing he's highly offended by is the word and use and application of tiki. Hawaii technically did not have tiki. We had ki'i images. And ki'i are gods. They are akua. They're the main akua. So they're not to be taken in a secular sense. They're to be treated with reverence and with respect. So taking an image of a Hawaiian tiki is really offensive to some. In contrast to that, Marquesan tiki represented deceased ancestors or chiefs who were believed to have been descendants from the gods, but they weren't gods themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're okay to be taken and replicated in a more secular way. They're not treated with quite the same reverence that a Hawaiian tiki image or ki'i image would be.
But if you were to create a unique new tiki style image, would that be okay? Or
you know, it's interesting because I personally don't have a whole lot of issue with the whole tiki thing. Mm-hmm. To me, I kind of see it as an American pop thing mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. totally separate from right. traditional Polynesian culture. And it started with the, 1940s, 1950s Trader Vic's thing. And right. and it's an American pop culture movement, very removed from the reality of Polynesian culture. But the last time I was out here, I had breakfast with a Maori filmmaker, Cook Island Maori, who I respect tremendously and who's very knowledgeable. And we had that discussion because she's working on a film on tiki. And she says, no, that even that's highly offensive and detrimental to our culture. Mm. Because what it does is it creates this whole misnomer as to what Polynesian art was. That people hear the term or the phrase Polynesian art and they think of these kitsch tikis, which hurts artists today that are trying to make a living doing, cultural art forms. That it really has had a detrimental effect over the years. So I see both sides. Personally, it's not one of my pet peeves or real passions, because again, personally, I've always kind of seen it as a separate phenomena. And I've come to know a lot of the people that do create these tikis and are very involved in the whole kind of kitsch tiki movement, and they're wonderful people. Mm-hmm. People, in many cases, that don't have a strong background or knowledge of the historical basis of it or what they're doing. But I do see it as kind of a unique, original art form in and of itself. And personally, I'm not offended, although many people are.
Interesting. Well, do you think that you'll come back next year?
Oh, sure. In fact, I will be back here mid-September. Mm-hmm. My schedule is always posted on my website, which is www.thepolynesiantattoo.com. And I'm also on Facebook. My best Facebook page for just tattoo fans is Tattoo Traditions of Polynesia. I do have a personal page there, but I have just too many friends that I don't know that just have an interest in looking at tattoo photos. So I'm starting to weed through that since Facebook limits it to 5,000. But please do add Tattoo Traditions of Polynesia. There's also a Polynesian Tattoo Appreciation page on Facebook, and I'm one of 5 administrators there. And that's a great place to just see beautiful photos because there's a lot of Polynesian style artists on Facebook. There's probably over 300 that post images pretty regularly. And some of them are not Polynesian at all. They're located in Europe, Brazil, in various other places, but doing some pretty impressive work. So just for looking at photos and design inspiration, that's a good place to go. But my schedule is always on my website, again, thepolynesiantattoo.com. And I also do a monthly newsletter with all the better links that I find. And I'm highly selective as to what goes out as a permanent link on my website. It has to be historically accurate before I'll add it as a permanent link. And any fun links that I find, I do put out in the monthly newsletter, so that's a good source also. And my schedule will be there. But you want to sign up in advance. Ideally, what I do is take a few weeks to go through the phone list, call everybody, get a sense for what they're wanting to represent, what style they like. And then we sit down and look at websites together on the phone, me and Hawaii and them out here, and say, okay, look at this site. Do you like that? Do you like that? And then I start sending them photos of things I've already done just to narrow down what they're drawn to stylistically and as far as size and body location and such. Mm-hmm. and we talk about meaning, and then I start sketching for them. So it's sometimes a lengthy process to design a piece for a person. And the sooner people sign up, the higher priority they'll have in scheduling. I do give scheduling according to the date of deposit. Mm-hmm. And the more time we'll have to create a piece that's really customized for them. Some of what I do is freehand, some styles. But we usually establish that beforehand on the phone. And then just sit down and draw it on with a surgical marker. And I do have a few openings out here this trip. I'm still at the museum through Sunday the 13th, and then I'm down in Oceanside for a week. And if it's a freehand piece or something I can prep on the road, I can get in some new clients, and I definitely am taking new clients for my next trips.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
It was really a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me as well. I've really enjoyed it.